You're listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
I'm hosting the podcast today, Freethinkers. I'll be talking to Ibrahim Abdullah. Ibrahim Abdullah is the founder of an organization called Muslimish, which is the organization that's producing this podcast. And he's going to be talking to us a little bit today about how he started Muslimish. This podcast really is no longer, we're not focusing today on how he lost his faith necessarily or his own personal story, but rather we are looking today and asking him about how he got the idea to start this organization, how he actually went about doing it. And hopefully this will help other people who are interested in starting similar organizations to promote free thinking amongst Muslims who are skeptical or Muslims who have lost their faith or people who just want to think about these issues in a space that promotes free thinking and safety at the same time. So, Ibrahim Abdullah, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And so I guess I'm going to talk today about like what made me start Muslimish. Why did I feel that was needed? And to go like straight to the point, I feel that it's because I feel that there was no space where people could discuss ideas that were considered taboo in Muslim culture. I realized that when I attempted to discuss with my friends inheritance laws. I grew up in Egypt.
Inheritance laws in Islam, you mean?
And in Egypt.
Okay.
And only, well, I mean, I wasn't really speaking about like in Islam or Egypt. I was just talking about a practical situation that I was facing, which is I have to write my will because, you know, in the United States, it's different than in Egypt. When you die, they divide your wealth according to Islamic Sharia without you even having a say in the matter.
Unless you write your will, which
even
is
if you do write your will, that will is only applicable on 1/3 of your fortune.
Oh, okay.
So even if you do write your will, based on your religion, which is something that is written in your ID card.
Determines who will inherit how much.
Yes.
Okay.
And also the problematic part for me was that it gives the boy double the girl.
And now you have a daughter. My understanding is you have a daughter as well as a son.
Yes, I have a daughter and a son, and I live in America now. So I feel that, you know, it's 50-50. That's what's fair.
So that was the practical situation that confronted you that made you feel there's no forum where I can speak openly about this.
And when I tried to speak, I was shut down. I was, attacked verbally.
Well, what was your position?
My position was, you know, I'm in America. I should in writing my will is that I want to, you know, I'm going to give my daughter half and my son half.
Right.
And people said, well, no, you shouldn't because the boy gets double the girl. And of course, they're all men saying this.
So these were your friends or
yes.
Your relatives? Or
my friends from high school, from college, people I grew up with. And, you know, I was, you know, the conversation got, you know, uglier and uglier. And I am a stubborn guy. I don't back down. And it ended up that I was angry that I was saying like, well, just let me tell you what else I think is wrong. These are a lot of things that are wrong. This is
how
wrong
did the conversation get ugly? Give me an example. So when you said you wanted your daughter to...
I don't really remember the details because this was like 2009, 2010.
Okay.
But it was, you know, I'm, you know, like, you know how like people in general, I guess in conversations on like when it goes on like a social like media forum, it gets a little testy. And
oh, this was on social media, yes, not yes. in private encounters.
I did not do this. Like, well, when I tried to speak about it, when I was in Egypt visiting, I was very quickly shut down. Everybody like, but and I didn't say my opinion further because I didn't feel comfortable at the time saying my opinion further. When I came back to New York, when I was sitting in my air-conditioned office, you know, I felt, you know, well, you know, this is something I want to talk about. And I wrote a little note that says, well, you know, I feel that these are traditions that have lost their value. They have lost their logic, and we should be able to speak about them. And I didn't, like, try to offend anyone. I was just trying, like, well, this is an idea that practically in our, like, it's not, it's a problem that's facing us.
It's a practical matter.
I have to make a decision about this. I have to decide what to do. And I think my decision is correct. And I don't. And I think it's morally the better decision. So
why do you think it's morally the better decision to have equal inheritance? I mean, the question might be obvious, but I actually would just like to know what your moral reasoning is.
I mean, why would I give my son more than my daughter? Like, when I give them, I'm their father, and when I give them allowance, I don't give them equal allowance. I don't give the boy double the girl. Like, there's no point. Like at no other situation in anybody's life do they give the boy double the girl. Why is it like that when they actually, like, you know, when you're gone, when you're gonna be dead, when there's really nothing else you could do for them, is you gonna give the boy double the girl? Like, why? Why would you do that?
Well, there's a whole logic behind it, that the women don't work, and therefore she'll have somebody to support her. But then things have changed, and women actually now very often are the ones supporting the family. And so these circumstances can change.
Yeah.
And so I totally agree with
and,
you.
And I was even, like, making the argument that I'm in New York. I am not in Egypt anymore. This is... You know, my daughter's life is not going to be dependent on a man, hopefully. I hope she's be like, you know, and I, you know, it's not how we want to set your kids up. That's not how I want to, like, want
so
to
that's
teach
how
my
it started.
Daughter.
So that's how it started for you.
Yeah. And like, everybody's like, basically, like, and then, like, it just, they basically, like, they were telling me I was wrong. Like they were telling me that things like, well, you're not going to, like, have your son be a real man. What does that mean? Like he has to learn to take care of his sister. I'm like, how many brothers do you see take care of their sisters in the world?
Exactly.
Like, let's be practical. I'm just, like, you know, I'm just saying, like, and not that, like, they shouldn't take care of each other. I'm not
but
saying
to
that.
Take care of someone or
that.
Support someone.
But I'm saying, like,
is
just,
a completely
like,
different.
Like, why would I, like, give him double? There's just no point in that for me. And then I was just, everybody was saying basically, like, that if I disagree with this, then this is wrong because I'm disagreeing with God.
Okay.
And that it came to that. You're disagreeing with God. And I'm like, you know, well...
So you come back to the States and you continue this conversation on social media?
Yeah.
Okay, describe that for
well,
us.
Well, that was just... Well, I didn't even go into... Like, when I was speaking, I don't claim that I have gotten into depth in discussion with my friends when we were together. It was really when I came back that, like, you know, I started writing about it, like, just, I don't even remember the details exactly. And I'm sure if I can go back on Facebook and find this stuff. But it's like, you know, because it's like, it's there. But it was basically like, there's, like, something wrong with your heart. Like, and, like, you know, your kids are, like, better off if, like, they didn't have you as a father.
Oh, that's what people were telling you.
Yeah. And that, like, you know, pissed me off.
That pissed you off.
Yeah.
That would piss me off too.
So I was like, I went off and I said, you know, a lot of things. And I mentioned all the other things that I didn't believe. Like, you know what else doesn't work? Woman's testimony being half a man's testimony doesn't work. That is stupid. And I called it, like, and I started getting more, like, saying, like, just getting it out of my chest. Because there was a lot that I was holding back at first.
So you were enjoying the freedom of just being able to say
what
you wanted.
I was like, you know what? You guys are morons. You're just morons, all of you. Bunch
that's
of
a bit harsh.
That's how I felt, and when people are just like they're telling me there's something wrong with me because I want to give my daughter equal inheritance as my son, and then they tell me there's something like and then that my kids would be better off if I wasn't their father. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's
you are who like
how can you say that to someone because you disagree with them?
And you know what? And the truth, I'm right. And that's really what mattered to me. Like in my head, I have, you know, I'm I guess arrogant.
And a little bit.
Maybe a little. I'm getting better. I'm trying, but.
But you felt strongly about this, and you really felt
I'm right. I am right. These are morons. I am right. They are wrong. I am not going to shut up.
No, they're not more. They have a different point of view. That doesn't necessarily. I mean, they may have their logic may not be sound.
Maybe morons is not the right word. But right. That's how I was angry. And I just got it off my chest, and then I was in America. So I was in a privileged position. I could sit in my, you know, in America and say my opinion freely without fear of, you know, somebody attacking me physically, which was...
So you were emboldened just by virtue of the fact that you were here.
Yes, well, I couldn't do this. I had some of my childhood friends threaten to kill me. So...
Literally.
And they
over
said,
this issue, particular over, issue, or well, others?
It went on.
Oh, it went on.
I didn't back down.
Right.
For
so you
years,
got
okay. For 3 years, every Ramadan I started writing, right? You know, because it was like my because I didn't fast anymore. So I'd start writing about things I think these are wrong. This is wrong. And this is wrong. I put them on the piece of wood. But it was, you know.
So it started to grow. So it
like
started...
you know what, and then like you know I started like you know looking more into things like this is like. The more I got into it, like this is like not good. Like if people think this is correct, it's not good for humans.
And did you feel lonely at that point because you were by yourself arguing against these people, or was there a community online that you could agree with?
No, there was no community online. I thought I was like, I didn't think I was the only one. I knew I saw people online, but they were all like not real people.
People that you knew. By real, you mean people that you actually sat down with and talked to. People you knew personally.
Not even with real names and real faces. Like in the beginning, it's different now. But in the beginning, when like it was like, you know.
So people didn't disclose their real identities.
No, always fake picture of like, you know, Statue of Liberty or I don't know, or like
okay, so you
Charles Darwin.
So you didn't know who you were talking to, really.
Yeah, they weren't real people. So, you know, and I didn't matter, but like you know, I remember that I've been in America as Muslim without a community for a while, and I was comfortable. I'm comfortable being alone. I don't need a lot of people. I don't think
so. Why did you start Muslimish if you were comfortable just being alone and knowing what your own ideas were? What
I was comfortable for a very long time.
What motivated you?
Because I met someone who thought like me, and that was awesome.
Tell me about that.
That was just like awesome. We were out, it was after the Egyptian Revolution. I was really starting to talk to Egyptians again because after that big problem, I kind of stopped talking to Egyptians. And like, you
and
know,
the revolution got you to speak to Egyptians once more.
Yeah, because I found some cool people, which, you know, they're not, you know, like there were some cool people. I was shocked. I went to Tahrir Square. I was there before Mubarak stepped down, and it was cool. I think things changed after Mubarak stepped down. That's my personal opinion. I could be wrong, but again, that's my
feeling too. That or people were able to come out and be themselves and be cool and ask. You know, I think it was kind of an utopian, ecstatic moment of freedom. There was this burst of energy and
there
people.
There was no taharosh. There was no sexual harassment.
Right, and people were.
I couldn't believe it.
People felt freer and able to talk about things in an exploratory way. Like they didn't have all the answers, but there was a lot of excitement and people were saying things that I think, and talking to people they may never have interacted with otherwise.
Yeah. So I was like, basically like we were out like partying and...
So this was in Egypt?
This was in New York.
Oh, afterwards. In New York, afterwards, okay.
And there was like, you know, we're out and there was, someone said there's like Kareem from Pakistan is coming. And I was like, oh, Kareem from Pakistan is coming. He's probably going to be like some, you know, conservative guy. That's what I, you know. And
that was your stereotype
my
of
stereotype
Kareem,
of
from,
Kareem
Pakistan.
From Pakistan. Yeah. Kareem from Pakistan. And of course, Kareem from Pakistan comes and the first thing is like, hey, Ibrahim, salamu alaikum. I was like, dude, I am not Muslim. And he said, neither am I. And it was just like, what? You're Kareem from Pakistan? And you're, like, you just said that? And he said, yeah. And then we started talking and like, it was awesome because he, like for the first time, I'm talking to a person who agrees with me on the most fundamental thing that I've been almost like for like and 4 years.
And who grew up in the same faith as you, so knew exactly, like you didn't have to explain yourself.
Yeah,
he understood
like how like these people like don't like, why are they like, they're all wrong. Yes, they are all wrong. Millions and millions of them are wrong. And like, you know, like you just, what? You and it was.
But do you think that they're wrong, or do you think
wrong.
That this is one way that people choose to live, and you no longer want to live like that? And
there's no invisible man in the sky. There's just none. Okay, they're wrong. I just like and to like to have our lives like be like an issue. Again, another practical issue. I like, let's
so
like,
no, but tell me about Kareem before you go on, because I kind of want to get a sense of the emotional impact that that had on you, and then how
it's
that
so odd. It was like, it was like he was coming to really like to hit on a girl, and he stopped talking to her and he started talking to me, and that's like, and I thought that was awesome,
because you guys were awesome. So engrossed in the subject,
because the conversation was so much better than his attempt to, you know. No, pick up this girl.
And what was his reaction like? So you've told us that it was very exciting for you to find someone who agreed with you. How did he feel?
I felt, I felt that he was happy. We were just sharing so much information. Like I was telling him, like, did you know this? It's like, oh yeah, well, did you know this? I'm like, oh my God, did you know this? It's like, yeah, like, did you know this? And it was just like, until like, it was late. I missed my last, it was like 4 a.m. Like, you know, the bars were closing and we were like, you know, and we went to eat. Like, you know, like it was a perfect New York City, like, night. And it was just...
And you guys couldn't stop talking.
We couldn't stop talking.
And so the conversation
and
became very
everybody else
big.
Around us, I could see it, like, that they were, like, they were all Muslims in various degrees of being Muslim. They're still out with us. So they're not, like, really, like, super Muslim. So... You know, they are watching this, and I can see like different things and emotions in their eyes. They're like, they're happy, but they're like worried, like because they just witnessed.
But something real was happening.
They witnessed like oh my God, this just.
But
like,
something really important was happening.
I felt something like oh my God, this, like, and I never needed, like I at least I didn't think I did. In my own head, I was like, I'm perfectly fine alone. I can be by myself. I don't need anybody.
So this was kind of a transformative moment in a sense.
It was just, and I thought, and it made me think, like, I just learned so much from this guy. And I know a lot. Okay.
About religion or in general?
About religion, about Islam, about history of Islam.
Okay. Oh, so he knew a lot about it as
he
well.
He did. And he
now, did
different
he grow
things.
Up, did he grow up very pious?
He went to Hajj, I think, 7 times.
Oh, wow. So he really knew about the faith.
I think, I'm an Arabic speaker, so I can, like, I have a very different perspective. That,
okay,
like,
so you can read the text,
the
original
text.
Understand
it. But he, like, he knew a lot of the, and he pointed me to one of my favorite books now, 27, what is it called, 27 years? Career of Muhammad's prophetic career, 27 years. And that book is I liked it a lot because...
I haven't actually heard about it.
We had it in the book club.
I must have missed that.
Okay, well, okay. We've got to get you that.
Yeah, you have to give me a copy.
Because it's a very interesting way he writes. Ali Dishti is an Iranian writer. And he still like calls Muhammad prophet. But he talks about it in a very practical way that appealed to me. That like he was talking about a career, I've never seen Muhammad's life written that way.
So less as a religious leader, but more as.
But still as a religious leader and as a tribal leader and as
a historical figure.
Yes, and it just was new way to me to read about it, because you know I all have read it like. Everybody's like, so like, oh.
The adulation and the adoration, yeah.
There was a little bit of that, but it's not like, it wasn't like Arabic writers that I've read like all my life. So that, and I liked it a lot. I liked the way he explained things.
And now this was recommended to you by your Pakistani friend, Kareem, whom you had met.
And after that, I wanted to meet others. So
it was really reconnecting you in a sense.
Well, I was...
Which is really interesting, because when you think about it, for many people, when they lose their faith, it they lose a community, whereas it seems to be like you're...
But I didn't have a community in New York.
You didn't have one to begin with, and it actually, this experience is causing you to reconnect. But that's an interesting twist.
You know, I wouldn't even describe it that way. But it wasn't like I was trying to find community. I was like almost...
But you were connecting to people.
I was connecting to people. I was trying to find almost like affirmation in myself that like I'm not the only one.
Right.
I'm not the only one. Everybody told me, oh, well, you think you're right and we're all wrong? You're the only one who thinks that.
So it was the idea that you had other people who were affirming what you now thought was...
Yeah.
Right.
So I tried to like find other groups. They're secular groups, and I wanted to like see other. So I went to like the Reason Rally after that.
Where was the Reason Rally?
That was in Washington D.C. I traveled for that in March 2012.
Okay.
And
you went by yourself.
I went by myself, and when I was doing that, I was couch surfing. So I found another Muhammad who was in D.C. for the Reason Rally. So I sent him a message. And I found,
So you found him online?
Online on Couchsurfing. Couchsurfing is a website that people like try to find. Like,
oh, that's okay. Got it.
And I was I was looking, like, if you're going to D.C. for the Reason Rally, you're my friend. And if your name is Muhammad and you're going to D.C. for the Reason Rally, I need to talk to you. So I like...
And he was Couchsurfing as well. He was on that. Okay.
Yeah. So that's, and I met another guy. And I met another, I met like four guys in D.C.
So there was a subgroup of Muslims who were at the Reason Rally.
Yes. And I met them. I met some, some people. And then I also connected with a group called CFI, Center for Inquiry.
They're in Buffalo, New York, I think.
I think they're New York headquarters now. I don't know. But like when they, back then, they had a person, they had a New York person, Sid Leroy. Sid Leroy was the New York City person.
Oh, so they have like an outreach person in New York. Got it.
And she was in D.C. and I...
So you connected with her.
I connected with her. And she is the one who came up with the name Muslimish.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. But she... I basically...
Tell us something a little bit about the name, because I think people really would like to hear. It's an interesting name.
So it just basically like we wanted to have a name that would be inclusive to both Muslims and people who left Islam or don't believe in Islam anymore but are connected to Islam.
So this is what distinguishes this group, that you are not exclusively ex-Muslims, but that there's a broad spectrum of belief or disbelief within the group.
Yes.
And a commitment to kind of pluralism.
Yes.
Okay.
And
so she came up with this name Muslimish, and she's the outreach person for the CFI in New York City.
Yes.
Great.
Well, we were working together on I was trying to I was explaining to her what I was thinking, and I was telling her that I want a group that where people can have discussion, can talk about subjects that like when I talked about with my friends, I was shut down very quickly, and that happens in all Muslim communities. Even if you go to groups, before I started Muslimish, I went to other groups in New York City that were like Muslim groups.
Like what?
There was the Progressive Muslims of New York.
Oh, you did have an experience with that. How was that?
There was one conservative guy who put everybody in line. Which is what happens in almost every...
Oh, even amongst the progressive Muslims, you felt
that
dynamic
was... There
was
one progressive guy, one male, conservative. One conservative male that puts himself in the position of the person who's going to remind everyone of what God says. And when that person speaks, no one challenges him.
What was their agenda? So these were still believing Muslims, practicing Muslims, but they had more progressive ideas. I mean, how would you characterize this group?
I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to describe them. I wouldn't want to do that.
You wouldn't want to do that.
No.
But I mean, how are they different?
They're just normal people who want to like live with Islam and want to call themselves Muslim. But they're just like they want to live their normal lives. But that's of course not how they would describe themselves. So that's why I don't want to like describe.
Okay. So you weren't it didn't satisfy you. This group did not ultimately.
It was just like I'm interested in speaking the truth in face of you know, lies that have been considered the norm by the masses. So I'm not interested in bowing my head to this conservative guy who expects everybody to just shake their head, you know, and say, yes, yes, brother, yes, brother. And like, and even if they...
So you left this group?
Well, it's not like what I'm looking for. And it's not, and I looked in other groups, even like there were that group, I don't know if it's even like, and I went to like the Quran discussion group, which was very like Sufi in nature. But like I went there because I saw they had this ayah. They wanted to discuss the ayah, Yudullahu man yasha. It was part of like,
could you translate that to
Yudullahu man yasha, God misleads whoever he wants.
Okay.
And they wanted to discuss it, and they went on and on, and like I just went to listen. And they went on about how great that was. And I'm like, how is that good? God misleads whoever he wants, and this is a good thing? You guys are like, and then like they were completely shocked that I exist, that my existence is real. And you know what? Then even there is another. Well, I don't want to like.
Right. No. So let's.
My point is, there was no space where you can say this is wrong,
or even discuss. You're saying.
Yeah, it's just, and it's wrong. This is wrong, wrong, wrong.
Well, let me ask you a question. Why didn't you join an American humanist or secular organization?
Well, why would I do that?
Well, I'm asking you. Tell me.
I have no desire to do that.
Why not?
I went to see other secular groups. I went to CFI meetings. They're fun.
But what was
it? I went to New York City atheist group.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, it's a good meeting, but it's like not my people.
What do you mean?
Not my people. Like the food, the talk, the jokes, the you know.
So there was something in the culture
there was
that
something
you...
that was just not my I liked when I talked to Kareem from Pakistan.
Why?
Because it was like he got it. He got what I was talking about. Because
you also were talking about
he got
knew
what
you were
about. Like there's nothing in American Christian culture that is even close to Islam. Even the most conservative, okay? And I've met some conservative Christians. It's nothing, like, doesn't even come close to moderate people in Islam. It's like every.
Well, this is the cultural concept text.
Yeah. And if you haven't lived through that, you don't get it. The only people that I think.
So like, you wanted to be able to talk with people
that
who got
it,
and you didn't have to explain it, and you didn't have to provide the cultural context all
yeah.
the time.
And I'll tell you, this is one more thought is that. The only people that come close that I can talk to them about this stuff and they get it is Orthodox Jews.
Interesting.
It's very interesting. They're the only people like they
get it.
They get it. They get it because
why
it's like that. Because it's really like that. It's that, you know, inclusive of every aspect of your life, everything you do. You know, especially like anyway.
So that motivated you then to create your own group?
Well, I thought like, you know, that like I wanted to meet others. And Sid Leroy suggested that I start a meetup group. And that's how it started.
So it started as a meetup group?
As a meetup group.
How many people came to your first meetup group?
Two.
Two.
Two. Kareem from Pakistan. And
same Kareem or another
same
group?
Kareem from Pakistan.
Same Kareem, okay.
And another guy who I think was a cop. I'm pretty sure he was a cop. He never came back again. His story didn't make any sense to me. And yeah.
Did that discourage you or did you insist on having more meetups?
It was interesting because it was very interesting. It made like because in the beginning I was pissed, I was upset, like something like, you know, like why is the police like surveillancing me? But then I was like, well, maybe that's a good thing. Like this is how my own I'm trying to be very aware of this, but I think this was the beginning of me being more supportive of like police in general.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
Because you said this group should be under surveillance.
No, I just we are able to operate because there's police.
Oh, because it made you feel safe is what
yeah,
you mean.
Okay. It made me feel safe.
It made you feel safe.
Yeah.
That nobody was going to see your name on the meetup and come and kill you. It made you feel safe. Is that
yeah.
what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, I'm not sure, but like it just made me, I don't know. I can't like answer that.
So how many meetups did you have before this kind of turned into an organization? Like, walk us through that.
Well, it was like, you know, I started in May 30th, 2012. May 30th, 2012. And by December, I was put in touch through CFI again, through Sid Leroy, and to with someone in Detroit. They said you should talk to this guy.
What's his name? This person.
Wissam Sharafeddin.
Okay. Now, how did he get in touch with CFI? Was he on a similar trajectory as you had been on?
I think so. He was like, you know, yes, I'm pretty sure, yes. And he was like attending CFI meetings and stuff. And they thought that, like, you know, I was looking for, you know, people, you know, with that.
With like-minded mindset, people.
Like-minded people. So they put us in touch. And
so CFI put you and Wissam Sharafeddin in touch.
Yes.
With each other.
Yes.
Okay.
And Wissam brought in like the know-how that made this organization real. Like he had worked, I think, with Muslim groups in the past to start nonprofit organizations.
Because he was an imam. He's a former
yeah.
imam.
And he has the community links. Like I don't have a community in New York. Like I didn't have that, like a community like established here. He had that connections and.
He's in the heart of Arab American community
yes.
in Michigan. In
yes.
Detroit.
Yes. And
Dearborn, Michigan,
yes.
right? Okay.
And I had asked them to put, I think now I remember, if I remember correctly, I had asked them to find someone in Dearborn for me, CFI. Like,
okay.
So find me in contact in Dearborn. Because if I remember correctly, that again, that was 2012. So
end of 2012, beginning of 2013.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, again, not exactly, but it's around then. And Wissam, by 2014, Wissam and I had like started a nonprofit organization. And
you stuck with the name Muslimish.
Yes, yes, and I think it's a good name. I mean, some people don't like it. I think it's a good name.
I'm a little ambivalent about it, but I don't.
It's a lot of people don't like it. I don't know why, but.
So you and Wissam are basically the two people who founded the organization.
Yes, yes,
okay.
Officially, yes.
And you got along well in terms of you were a good team. No, but also in the sense of you had complementary skills.
Yes, he was able to like you know start a nonprofit organization and get that done. He started the group in Detroit. We balance each other.
So there's a chapter now. So at that point, there was a chapter in Detroit as well as a chapter in New York.
Yes. And that was the biggest, like the first city that we started. And we had another group in Chicago that didn't really continue and stop because the organizer left. And we had a group in DC that, you know, that didn't continue. And but now we have a group in Boston that I feel is, I love, that I feel is kind of solid.
But let's backtrack a little bit. So talk a little bit about how you and Wissam worked together to actually establish Muslimish and how other people started coming in.
Yeah, I think we balance each other. I am, you know, like I have like this like more like revolutionary, like angry man, like aspect, and he's like the calmer. You know, like, let's think about this logically and, like, let's try, like, you know.
He gets the bureaucratic paperwork done.
I can dream and he can calm me down.
Yeah.
I think we work well. Like, because I thought, like, oh, I want to do this. He's like, just like, wait, just. And he, like, you know.
He's more systematic.
Yes. I think we work very well together. And I love Wissam. You know, I just love him. So.
Hope you're listening, Wissam.
Yeah. So that you know, I feel that, you know, we have a good group now.
So you established, you made it into a nonprofit.
Yes.
Organization. How many members do you now have in Muslimish?
I would say about 400, about, give or take.
And how many years has?
Since, well, we started as a nonprofit since 2014, but we started the first meeting in 2012. So, yeah, I think, I mean, I thought actually it would be bigger than that by now, but, you know, I'm a dreamer.
So tell me a little bit about the major activities that were started in New York by Muslimish. I know that you guys have conferences and other activities. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you hope to achieve or what you think these conferences have been able to achieve?
Yeah. Well, we have meetings twice a month, at least twice a month in New York, every other Wednesday. And I think we're going to change that to Thursday because we're having, change a little bit with the organizer in New York. And I like these meetings, but the conferences, they're like...
So are these usually annual conferences?
Well, we usually have annual conferences, but this last year we had two conferences. This year we already had two and we might have three. So we're starting to have more than one in different cities because...
So it started with the major conferences in New York City first.
Actually, the first one was in D.C. and Richard Dawkins was there. That was in 2013. And that was, we worked in that with the ex-Muslims of North America, although they weren't, I think, established organization at that point. But we worked with ex-Muslims of North America at that event. Richard Dawkins was there. It was a big event. It was about and that was our first, I'm calling this our first conference. And after that, we had a small conference in New York that wasn't very well organized. And but then the third one, I think went very well. And ever since then,
third one was also in New York City.
It was also in New York City.
Now, tell me what happens in these conferences, what kind of speakers you have, what kind of events?
Well, we have...
What's the main purpose of these conferences that you...
Many purposes, but I'm going to say one is to, for me, the best thing I like about it is that, you see a large group of people together for the, I love that because I was always told you're the only one. Who thinks like this. And I like being in a room where there's at least 100 people like me who thinks like me or at least not like me, but agree with the basic concept of being able to discuss ideas freely. It's really not that
it's not revolutionary. Science. It's not, yeah.
It's really very simple. Yeah, you should be able to discuss ideas without saying, well, this is against God's word. Do not say this. God says this is wrong.
Do you think that that's how many people who came to the conference also felt, that they were able to breathe and able to speak freely about these issues?
I think so. I mean, I love it. I see it more in the smaller meetings than every other Wednesday. Because you see someone who's really been alone and never seen anyone before, and they come oh my God, you're I'm not the only one. And it just, for me personally, it's therapeutic because I was, at a place where I was like that, and I feel like, oh my God, I'm able actually I'm able to help.
If the meetups have this therapeutic aspect, but surely the conferences may have a therapeutic aspect, but surely there must be something more.
Yes, well, we're trying to also get different views, point of view. I was starting with what I like, but really the purpose is to have different points of views from within the group because we're a very diverse group. I consider myself on the extreme, militant fraction of Muslimish.
Okay,
which does exist, and we are.
How would you describe that, the militant aspect of Muslimish?
We are people who some of us are just clear about how religion is wrong and that we need to be able to speak about it that way, that it's wrong. This is wrong. This is not correct. It does not deserve...
So you're pretty militant atheists, pretty certain that religions are just...
Hocus pocus, okay. Yes.
So that would be the more militant,
yeah,
on the more militant spectrum.
Yeah,
but that doesn't represent the entire group.
Absolutely not. Okay. And I didn't want it to be that because why?
That's what I like about it.
Yeah,
because I think in the end it's a model for how. And I think that the secular movement is growing in many, many countries in the Middle East and beyond. And I think the future is people are going to have to figure out a way to accommodate and live with people with whose ideas they don't agree. And I think that in this sense, Muslimish really is an interesting experiment.
Yeah, I like the word experiment. I was told by a good friend, a common friend, I'll tell you later, who not to use that word. But I like it. I like it because, and I also see it a lot, like when with Muslimish groups in different cities, how they're so different. New York is different than Detroit.
Very different.
Very different.
Boston is very different.
Very different. They're all different cities, and they all have the group. And
so,
I just love
so the major group now, the major chapter is in New York.
I would say, I would claim that.
You would claim
I would
that.
Claim that.
Because you were the city organizer
yes.
for a long time.
Yes.
You know that it,
yes.
you sort of really created it
yes.
and worked on it. And,
yeah.
But in the spring, you guys had conference in Boston. So
yes.
let's talk about that a little bit. How did that come about?
Well, Jinan, you put me in touch with the humanist chaplain in Harvard University.
Greg Epstein.
Greg Epstein, who you had met in the Humanist Hub.
And I had given a talk.
You had given a talk there.
In January.
Yes. And he offered to help us start a group in Boston. We thought that the best way to do that is to start have like a little small conference, have maybe like 4 or 5 speakers and get interest for people who are, you know, would like be into that.
So a group of people from New York City and I think even from Detroit went to Boston and you guys had, we had a mini conference
yes.
in the Humanist Hub and
yeah.
Harvard. And if I can say something, because
yeah.
this is really, that is the spectrum that I feel I fit into, because I feel that the Humanist Hub at Harvard are very focused also not just on what they've left behind, but on building something that represents their values, their humanist secular values. And so they really appealed to me. It wasn't just about rebelling or saying that we no longer believe in religion, but it's also building communities and figuring out what are our values. What are we going to build? What is the alternative that we have to create for people?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that.
Yeah. Well, I hope we can do that in Muslimish. I think, like, you know, I hope that we're trying to show an alternative. You know, like, you know, there are a lot of people who have ideas that don't fit in that rigid conservative, point of view, and we should be able to speak freely and discuss these ideas freely.
And we should be able to also pick and choose from our traditions things that can be compatible and actually enrich humanist traditions.
Yeah.
The West doesn't have a monopoly on humanism.
No, absolutely not.
And
it's like the idea that like humanism or like just like being good in general is a like why is this a Western thing? Like
it's not. And we've had very rich secular cultures that there's so much to draw from.
Yeah, so you know I feel
so
like,
so in Boston you had a mini conference. Now that did that attract, did that help you create a chapter
I would claim yes, and I think you know it was very successful, not only because the content was excellent, but also like that for me I like having a group there. Now there's a group there now. There are people, you know, meeting among themselves, and that group is going to grow.
They have their own Facebook page.
They have their own, and they can. It's going to grow as long as they're like, you know, it's just like once you start, if you build it, they will come.
And a group of them will be coming to the next conference in New York City on June 23rd.
We do that quite often. We like travel between cities, and it's kind of nice because you know, you go to see different cities and. You know, there's a community there. There's already like a small group of friends there for you, you know, show you around. It's
And I also feel that the Boston chapter is different. Like, I'm very excited about it because I feel there are more members from the Maghrib, for example.
Yes.
And they bring a very different perspective.
Every city has a, like, you know, different feel to it. But it's good. I think it's good. And the other thing that we do, I think we do well, is we're pretty democratic. In you know, I mean, it can slow us down sometimes, but I think we are, you know, we have an executive board that meets regularly to make to take decisions and everything, and the, you know, the city organizers are in the executive board, because I feel that they need, they're the pulse for, like, you know, from the field, is like I would call it.
And that's where I like to use the word experimental. I think we're trying a lot of different things. This works, this doesn't work. How often should we meet? I mean, there's all kinds of really interesting debates that are going on. At our last board meeting, for example, people were talking about how we need to give the chapters more autonomy,
yeah.
that they should be able
more
to
autonomy?
Be... I mean, some people were saying that. Other people are saying, no, we have to go a little bit slowly. We have to make sure that we establish. But my point is that there seems to be a lot of democratic discussion,
yes.
and a lot of probing for what's the best way to go about
yeah.
doing this.
But we already have, like, different formats in different cities. Like in Detroit, for example, there's a president and vice president for the chapter, which we don't have in any other city. I don't know if that's going to, you know, like I'm just saying, like, we already have a lot of different ideas that are happening in different cities that are not
so there is
the same.
A kind of decentralization in terms of how things are being organized.
I see it that way.
Yeah.
I see it that way. And I think that's great. I think that's great.
So could you tell us a little bit about the conference that's coming up in New York?
Yes. Every conference is different, but this
very
one,
true.
Every conference is different, but this one is going to be really different, I think, because there's going to be there's going to be an art section, which, you know.
So what's why don't you tell us the title of the conference? That way people can.
Yes. The title of the conference is Advancing the Sciences, Cultivating the Arts, and Building Communities.
Okay.
I think, you know, we're trying to, like, focus more on the positive. We're trying to, like, what are we trying to do instead of what are we against? What are we for? And science and art, I think are essential foundation to, like, culture and just building a new way and building a community that is open to discussion and ideas and
but also that's fun to be in, because very
yeah.
often you go to these conferences, these secular conferences, and they're all about rationalism and reason, and they're dry, and there's not necessarily a lot of joy in them. And I think one of the things that I've noticed from talking to so many of the members is that there really is an unbelievable longing for community.
Yeah.
But there's also a real longing for art. I mean, I this is where it gets really interesting. People who are in the group, who grew up in very, very, very pious families, didn't often get very much exposure. I'm not saying this is a hard or fast rule
mm-hmm.
across the board, but very often didn't get a lot of exposure and are suddenly really interested in music, or are suddenly really interested in reading novels and fiction rather than just deriving meaning from scripture,
mm-hmm.
because secular education may not have been as emphasized. This is not the experience of everybody, but it's definitely the experience of some people
yes.
in Muslimish. And I think one of the things we're also beginning to figure out, that one way that you can cultivate and have a rich inner life is through the arts, is through philosophy, is through literature. And I think that seems to be the direction that some of us are already moving in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. And I think, you know, the conference is going to be a great opportunity to, like, try to experiment with that, like, with other group members. Everybody's going to, like, bring their art and we're also going to, like, be focusing on the sciences as well, which, again, is not something that we've done in past conferences. The other, you know, for me, a big deal is Maryam Namazi is going to be coming from London. And I didn't mention that in the beginning, but as I was talking to CFI in the beginning, I was looking for other Muslim groups, for people who left Islam, and I couldn't find any in America. And the only group I found was a group in London. And that was Maryam Namazi's group in London.
And what are they called?
The Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain. And Maryam Namazi basically, like, taught me how to, like, to organize and what to look for and what to do. And I'm so happy that she's going to be in the conference, because she helped so many people in so many countries, start groups.
What were some of the main things that you learned from Maryam Namazi?
To get allies, to try to like have a meeting in a central location, try to have a meeting in a public place.
So on the ground organizing.
On the ground organizing.
She's good at that.
Oh yes. And I had no, like, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know.
She really transferred her know-how.
Oh yes. So.
And was very helpful.
Very, very helpful. Very helpful. And she like took her time, and she Skyped with me from London and New York. And when then she came, and I met her in DC when she was there. That was, you know, and you know, I learned a lot from her. And every time I meet her, I've seen. I went to London, in 2015, I think, 2016, to like, I wanted to like see that group. I really wanted to see that London.
Oh, so
group.
You traveled
like
to
the London group.
So this is a global movement here we're talking about.
Oh yeah, like for me, like when I met the London group, that's where I see New York in 4 more years or 6 more years. They're ahead of us.
How many people are members in her group? How many?
I don't know, but their meetings were a lot more than ours. And they are better organized in many ways.
Where do they get their funding from? Do you know?
I don't know. And they're in Britain, so I have no idea. But they're just like, you know, I see them like how the group works together, how effective it is. I love that group, and I love people there.
So she will be coming to speak in New York.
Yes, and of course Ali Rizvi, who is the author of the Atheist Muslim, which I feel is a very, you know, it's a great book. It's so conclusive of so many arguments that are talked about that subject, that, you know, I feel it's a great book to have, and it
shows. There's an entire genre of books now that's coming
out
about. Yeah,
there's no question about it.
These are no longer individuals. These are people writing books. These are people organizing groups. These are people who are attending conferences internationally.
Yes,
I know that.
And organizing internationally.
And organizing, I know
between,
that
between the United States, England, France, Scandinavia, the Sweden and Denmark, and Australia. Like there's a movement, and we're connecting with each other because our numbers are fairly small. But it's like when
they're growing.
But they're definitely growing.
They are definitely
growing. And it's way like Ali Rizvi mentions this. We're a long, long way from the days of Salman Rushdie. Long way from the days of Salman Rushdie.
When if anybody spoke, there would have been a fatwa, right?
So this is there is real progress. I don't care. I see it.
I agree with you.
I
agree with you. And I think it's a very self-aware movement. Whereas before, people are really, you know, people are aware that. And I think it's also happening, you know, there are a lot of people in Muslim-majority countries who are organizing and who are getting very involved, who are producing YouTube videos.
And I love them, but we have the freedom here to really organize.
But I understand that, and we have to amplify their voices. But what I'm saying is that in spite of the unbelievable risk that people have to take, that there are still people who are speaking out and who are meeting and who are organizing.
Yeah. And what I'm trying to say is that's why it's on us, the people who actually have the freedom to meet because we can.
And to amplify their voices.
Because we can. And I just, like, it almost feels like
it's a responsibility that you have the privilege.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm crazy, but I do feel that way.
Now, where do you see Muslimish going in the next 5 years?
Well, 5 years, I hope that we're going to be in every major city in the U.S. and Canada in 5 years. That's what I would like. I think we're working towards that. It's just like sometimes you just can't rush things. Things will happen when it's the right time for them to happen.
But other than increasing numbers, what do you think are some of the goals that the organization has or should have or should be?
I don't know.
Working towards.
I don't know. I mean, I think we have clear goals, and I'm going to, like, I think it's good to have, we have three goals. One is to create a place for discussion. So that's creating new cities. Two is foster a pluralist society. And again, that's in new cities, we're showing that and practicing that. because it's a, you know. And then the third is to abolish, strive to abolish blasphemy laws. So long term, I hope that we're going to be like hopefully a lobby that is able to affect things to like abolish blasphemy laws, abolish blasphemy. So in my mind, if there was no law in a country like Egypt that prohibits people from criticizing Islam, that religion would fall.
But don't you think this need to abolish blasphemy laws is kind of inseparable from supporting movements of social justice that seek to increase civil liberties in general? And that, so is there a component, or are there people within Muslimish who also feel that people have to start also getting committed to social justice issues and creating alliances with other groups? Because in a sense, it's not enough to change the laws, but you also have to create cultures,
yes,
that are more democratic and that are also have humanistic depth, so that people come to understand pluralism with all of the humanist traditions and varieties and different ways of living. So really, how do you feel about that? Because personally, I feel that it's as important to create, to help build cultures that are tolerant. Because if you change the law, but people are not tolerant, then there's a limit to what you can.
Yeah, but, you know, and I agree with you. I think that the social justice aspect is important. I do see a little bit of like a separation between the two, in my mind at least. I feel that, social justice is harder to achieve. So it's almost, in my mind, I don't want to I'm trying to do something very hard. I don't want to try to do something that's even harder in addition to the very hard,
yeah.
You know? So in my mind, I have to like separate the two because I want that.
But in a sense, if you
and
think...
It's something I feel like social justice, there you need a whole, you need a lot to achieve that. You need the infrastructure to achieve it. But changing a law that prohibits free thought and free expression...
Oh, you think it's a very limited concrete...
It's just delete. All it needs is just to delete this. And it will, I think, will have a huge effect.
But if you think about it, when you started talking about inheritance laws, you weren't prosecuted by the law. It was a social.
Because I was not in the United, because I wasn't in Egypt.
But it was the social reaction to what you were saying that you felt. That needs to change too.
Yeah.
And so that's
The law wouldn't be another sword above your head. I think it's just a concrete thing that I can look at.
I agree with, but I guess what I'm trying to say is it's really all very overlapping and interconnected.
And it is, and by creating a community, by creating groups that, you know, are like, I'm going to call them like melting pots of ideas, we are creating a narrative. We're creating a new way.
Narratives, counter-narratives.
That will, you know, help at the point when the discussion is allowed. First, the discussion has to be allowed, okay? Right now, the discussion is not allowed by the law of the land. I don't even know what will happen after we lift that sword. But I want it removed. I know it's a positive thing. It's something that is concrete, I think is easy to achieve. Relatively, than social justice, for example. That's just, like, to me, that's so much harder to achieve than just deleting one portion of the law that doesn't make any sense anyway. And I think there is...
But attitudes have to change for people, for laws to also be effective.
But once you... I could be wrong. I feel that once you remove the law, people will be able to speak freely. These discussions will happen more. There's going to be a backlash in the beginning. There's going to be some friction in the beginning. But afterwards, people will have heard ideas. If you can't...
But in a sense, Muslimish is doing the cultural work right now on the ground.
I would like to think
by
that.
Promoting these kinds of ideas.
Yes.
And I think also a lot of new atheists and a lot of people in the secular movement have been also criticized for not looking inward enough sometimes and looking at problems of sexism and racism within the movement. Do you think that this is a problem in Muslimish? Has there been, there are people in the movement, for example, who think Islamophobia is a problem, others who don't?
Yes, there's definitely this disagreement. there's definitely this disagreement. But I think it's fine. And I don't, like, you know, I think that, I don't know, you and I disagree on this.
Right.
Because, like, I don't think, first of all, I don't even like the term new atheist, but, like, I know what you mean by that. And I think their problem is they're just, like, so self-absorbed. And it's not like they're just, like, everything is, like, you know, like, what will you think I'm Islamophobic? Like, who cares? I don't care. Like, this, like, so, they worry about this too much, I think. Or, like, you know, so, but, you know, have this disagreement within the group, yes. We have people who think Islamophobia is a problem. We have people who think Islamophobia is a joke. But even people who think Islamophobia is a joke, they would, like, they acknowledge the existence of anti-Muslim bigotry. Okay, so we don't have people who don't think who are racist. Basically, we don't have racists because it's our people. Because we don't have. I wouldn't say we have Islamophobes, but we do have. I would say some people who have not talked to Muslims for a long time, and that does have an effect on you. But I understand that because I went through it.
I think also my personal feeling also is because I grew up in a very very liberal secular household. I think a lot of people are very traumatized sometimes
by the
experiences that they go through, and that it is possible sometimes, and I'm going to say this, and this may not be a very popular opinion, but that it is possible when you are so angry at a culture or at a faith that has really caused you to legitimate suffer. I mean, your suffering is legitimate. I'm not detracting from that at all. But then that you can sort of sometimes internalize Islamophobic notion. I think that that can happen. And I think it's a very fine line.
The problem I have with the word Islamophobic is that you really should fear Islam as an ideology. I mean, if you don't fear Islam as an ideology, you're really not paying attention to Islam.
Well, I don't think Islam is one thing, so I would disagree with you there. But
I have a problem with that word because, you know, for me, Islam is the Quran. And when I read the Quran, it's like, you know, it doesn't...
Do you know what I have a problem with?
What?
I have a problem with people who complain about Islamophobia, but rarely show empathy for Muslims when they're being prosecuted or are the targets of oppression or racism, structural racism. And I actually very often will go by my feeling of, if I feel people have true concern for the well-being of Muslims, as opposed to this tendency to find fault all the time with everything in Islam because it kind of turns into a kind of self-righteousness of proving that you have a superior culture. And that's why I think looking at different kinds of fundamentalisms in a cultural context and comparatively to each other is really important. So, for example, there's very little talk about how, for example, fundamentalist Muslims compare to fundamental Hindus now. You have Modi in India and Muslims. And I think that is what makes me nervous. And that's where I feel, you know, it's semantics after a while. What I'm really interested in is when I notice who actually cares about the well-being
of
people.
How would you know who cares? That's impossible to know.
That's where I think the commitment to social justice really for me makes a difference. So if you are not at all paying attention to instances of real persecution of Muslims and recognizing that this one faith doesn't have a monopoly on fanatical thinking, that you can think comparatively and deeply about how it works in different historical contexts, and you feel people are not being attentive to Muslims when they're victimized, and if you're not curious to learn about how particular verses of the Quran are interpreted in particular contexts and you think it's just this monolithic, indistinguishable whole. I think it's how you go about doing it that kind of guides me. And it's a very, very, very difficult thing to do. It's very, very difficult. You know, I often, even personally, alternate between being really angry and then getting a little defensive and saying, but other people, you know, because I also think that the thing is, it's very easy to bash Muslims within this context. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in seeing people have the freedom to live more fulfilling lives and to either follow their faith or not. I'm interested in having people within Muslim communities and Muslim majority countries respected and accepted even if they no longer practice the faith. I think that the non-believer is still the ultimate other and is not treated with sufficient respect. And I think there has to be reciprocity. And I think that's what we have to demand.
I don't agree with everything there, but because I don't demand respect from anyone and I don't, you know, give respect to people who don't deserve it. So, you know, I...
Maybe respect is not the right
word. Respect for
way.
Me is earned, yeah. Like, you know, like you have to, you kind of have to earn it, you know.
But I mean, having our rights and our humanity acknowledged.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe that's the better way. Maybe I misspoke in using that word. But
yeah, I'm a little sensitive to that word.
human, but having our human rights acknowledged.
Yes. And everybody, and I think, like, you know, that it's, for me, the right to say my opinion. And I like to actually hear other opinions that are different from mine because I learn something from them, as long as there's something intelligent in it. Like, you know, like I like people who have their own ideas, because if you're going to come to tell me the idea that you heard from the sheikh, well, I've heard that before. I want to hear your idea.
Right, I want to learn something.
I want to know what you think. Like, what, because every, like, and I feel that to create a space where this discussion happens, you're going to get exposed to so many different ideas. Something good is going to happen. You're going to get something good out of that. That's
what, and I think that's what Muslimish is doing.
That's what I hope it does.
And with that, we'll end this really fun. I had a lot of fun talking to you. That was good. Thank you, Brahim.
Thank you,
Gina. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.